Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to the 91st episode of the Get Your Film Fix podcast, otherwise known as the Get Your Film Fix podcast 3.0 episode 2. Today we're going to be discussing Baby Driver, the newest film from Edgar Wright, which will lead us right into a discussion on his career and our thoughts on him. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the latest and greatest from Netflix, but more importantly, the way that they've chosen to distribute some of their produced films. Finally, we're going to wrap everything up with our top five bar scenes.
Shop, let's talk it. The target is an armored truck, the Perimeter Trust, 10 a.m. sharp. Bank is right next to the switch car, baby.
I got a question, Doc.
Why'd I believe phones over here heard a goddamn word you said? He ain't even listening.
Baby, the target is an armored truck at Perimeter Trust in Dunwoody, 10 a.m. sharp. The switch car is ready, but you want me to hit the long stay parking structure and get a heist vehicle that stays colder longer? It needs to be ready for an 8:30 start. Questions?
Baby Driver came out this year. We're trying to catch up on this past year's movies a bit. And Edgar Wright is a director, I think, whether you like him or you don't, at least warrants a discussion as a filmmaker. But before we get into Edgar Wright himself, what were you guys' initial impressions on Baby Driver, the sort of action musical, in a way, that Edgar Wright made? And I feel like we're going to have some disagreements with that sigh here, Chape, and it sounds like you didn't like it so much.
Yeah, I mean, well, this is a nice thing about the podcast, right? We can come back and revisit things. When did this come out? Was this like the summer, early summer, or?
Yeah, towards the beginning.
June or July.
I saw it in the theater. I was really excited to see it. I think you kind of prefaced this in your intro a little bit on Edgar Wright. I think he's a very interesting director, not someone I find myself being attracted to a lot of times, but he's someone who clearly has a defined talent and a vision for his movies, whether you like him or not, as you said. When I left the movie, I think my sort of condensed single emotion from it was that it was a little bit overrated. I didn't quite see what all the hype was about. And then I rented it again in preparation for this podcast on Friday night. I don't know what happened. I really disliked this movie. After seeing it again, I think I was able to clarify some of my feelings, and I came out of it annoyed. I was annoyed for most of this movie.
Okay. Well, before you get there, let me just start by saying I really loved the first half of this movie.
Now, I remember you saying that last week. You say first half, to what point is that? Where are you drawing the half line?
Where Jamie Foxx and John Hamm come back for their final sort of heist.
Right.
Once that meeting starts, at that point, it really falls down, goes off a cliff for me. But the first half, I think, is great filmmaking. It's fun. It's, like I said in my intro, it's sort of a action musical. Everything is sort of paired to music in a really cool way. And you know how big of a sucker I am for when film and music can be paired and work together like that. I'm I'm a sucker for that. And I think he does it so brilliantly in this. I just totally got taken in on that first half of that movie. And then the movie seemed to completely stall and didn't know where it was going, didn't know how it wanted to end. It seemed to almost be on repeat a little bit towards the end. So, I don't know. I could watch the first half of this movie over and over again and never get sick of it. I would literally stop it, for the second half though. I just, it fell off a cliff for me.
Now that's really interesting. I'm going back to what I was saying last week about how, Jeremy, I think you're probably the most objective reviewer out of the three of us, and I thought you were in the Brantley days as well, and I wonder if that's maybe what's happening here, because, Lee, I feel like, what are your thoughts? I feel like you might be on my side a little bit here.
Well, I definitely had the exact same reaction as you when I came out of the theater seeing it this summer.
Overrated.
I felt it was a little overrated, and it was one of those movies where I was like, okay, like, I liked it fine, but, like, I didn't really see a whole lot about it that was overly impressive. And then, like you, I also rented it this weekend to revisit it, and I sort of went at it from a different approach, though. I paid a whole lot more attention to the direction of it because I knew we're gonna be talking a lot about Edgar Wright. Mm-hmm. And from a filmmaking standpoint, I was really amazed. Like, I think this is, I mean, Jeremy, you called it a musical. I called it more of a music video, like, in the best sense of the term. I thought it was really, really great filmmaking. But ultimately, the story was pretty basic. I mean, I didn't have a problem with it. I wouldn't go so far as to say I disliked it. But for me, I didn't divide it in half either. I kind of felt the same way throughout. It was sort of just a basic story, which I kind of was okay with. I think I was more just admiring the work of Edgar Wright than anything else.
Yeah, and he's such a... I mean, I love Edgar Wright as a director. I think he is such a fun filmmaker because he uses film to its fullest, unlike a lot of directors where it's just... maybe I should pause on this.
No, I think you're going. You should keep going. Keep going on that.
Okay. So like Edgar Wright is known for a lot of comedies, a lot of sort of fun action scenes, and he, as a filmmaker, utilizes film to its fullest. It's not just like a lot of these like Lee, you and me complain all the time about these comedies. That a lot of people really love, and I don't dislike them, but we're, you know, the Anchormans of the world or the Step Brothers and stuff like that, where you're just like, where a lot of it is just the filmmaking itself is secondary to the comedy. It's really about, you know, a couple people almost improvising while, you know, a couple cameras run. While as Edgar Wright, it is more about, everything's about the frame and utilizing film as part of the comedy or the action or whatever he does. And in Baby Driver, it's obviously more for the action, but, you know, between the music and his filmmaking, it's pretty amazing, really.
Okay, I completely agree with you about all of his other work. The editing is on the camera angles, you know, those sort of Wes Anderson-esque whip pans that are played for effect. They're funny. You know, I think what you're getting at is in those other films, his style really works to reinforce the comedy. The mise-en-scène, the camera work, the editing, all of that is played to the effect of the comedy aspect of those movies. It enhances.
But I think in Baby Driver, it's like it's done for the effect of the action. Like it's that same thing, but it's almost on overdrive in a way, especially that first half of the movie. I think it's done brilliantly.
I completely disagree. I just felt there was no reason for it. It was the, what was he trying to do?
Really? You didn't like that first balletic those shots
with the, it, I mean, really, okay. So we should go for those people who haven't seen it. The main Baby Driver, the main character has tinnitus or something, right? So he's a getaway driver for bank robbers, and he's got to wear, he wears headphones that's hooked up to an iPod that plays music, and the movie basically, we all remember this from our film school days, diegetic to non-diegetic sound. I assume, you know, we as the audience are basically hearing everything Baby Driver is hearing. It's, mm-hmm. It's a variety of different songs, mostly pop songs, and the movie is cut very specifically to the beats of the song, so much so that there's an opening shot where he goes and buys coffee for all the other criminals in the gang, and it's a one solid, you know, 2 or 3 minute tracking shot, And there's even, I didn't notice this the first time I saw it, but the lyrics of the song are like written on the wall in graffiti.
Apparently it took them 28 takes.
I don't know why. I don't know why you spent all that time doing that. I also saw a No Film School article about how like the editor was on set cutting, which is actually, I've seen that done before. But he was actually sometimes on the process trailer with a laptop cutting the feed from the video assist. Mm-hmm. So obviously editing was really important here. But oh man, I mean, it was for no reason. I found that annoying.
Really, that's filmmaking. That's what we normally love.
But you just identified that Edgar Wright does it. He plays this in the past. He's used this skill, this style of his filmmaking, to enhance the comedy, to make what he does funnier. It was almost as if it was showing off. It was like La La Land meets a car chase and. I didn't like La La Land, and I love car chases, but to me it was too much. It just seemed like it was showing off. It just seemed like he identified what you're talking about, Jeremy. He said, you know, I thought it was a brilliant thing you said. I remember you said it like 10 or 15 years ago to me. Like, the best moments in movies are when you combine a great piece of music with some great filmmaking, and it's as if Edgar Wright heard that and said, I'm going to make an entire movie based on that sentiment.
Great. And, good for him.
But
do you know how depressing it is like, to hear you say that we said something to each other 10 or 15 years ago?
It is depressing. We are old.
No, but here's the thing. Like, if you found it distracting or you found it showing off or whatever, you're not going to be able to shake that watching it, because that's, I mean, it's sort of, it's in your face. But for some reason, as much as we, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for, but as much as we complain about stuff that's showy, we also love, like, we love directors that have a distinct style and, you know, go out there, the PTAs of the world, and the Scorsese, we love it. I mean, ultimately, that's what we go to films for. And I think Edgar Wright is up there, and you know, as far as able to pull it off. And you just don't think he can pull it off on this one, or he didn't pull it off on this one.
No, I thought he pulled it off fine. I thought he did what he does, but it was to no end. There was no purpose for it. There was no reason for it. And the movie was so much about that fusion of music and editing and cinematic techniques.
But that was the whole concept of the plot. I mean, that was the reason he did it. It's not like he did it out of nowhere. I mean, literally the main character walks around with an iPod and drives getaway cars. I mean, it all works together in that way.
Like, so I think that this is...
You know, if he did it and he was a dog walker and he never listened to music, that would be weird. But, in the context of the movie, it works.
And so I just think that it's I don't know, you guys are obviously on opposite ends of the spectrum here with this movie, but I feel like you're looking at the wrong things here. Like, to me, this movie is like...
So Chapin, Lee basically just thinks we're both wrong somehow. This is good.
Well, no, sort of. Like, I think... To judge this movie, like the way I look at it is it's almost Soderbergh-esque in its experimental style. Like, I feel like all he was doing here was kind of playing with the medium and playing with music and playing with his filmmaking, because the story was so basic. Like, I could have written this story in the third grade. Like, right. it had nothing to do with the movie. And I feel like he did this to kind of just work with the medium. And maybe it was, the Kevin Spaceys and Jamie Foxx and John Hamm's in the car chases that made it a little bit more bankable to a wider audience. And as a result, it kind of became a little bit more of a mainstream movie, unlike some of Soderbergh's work, like, The Girlfriend Experience and things like that. But that's how I look at this movie. Like, where it succeeded.
You have to admit, the car chases were awesome. Like, this is like, I tried to watch Fast and the Furious the other day because it was on HBO, like one of the middle ones. It's so boring. Like, those car chases are just so pedestrian in how they're filmed and how, you know, the audience sees them. And this is totally different. I'd rather watch one of these car chases than an entire Fast and Furious movie.
But that's because of the way he times them with the music that's playing. And that's where I call it a music video. And
because he's a good director.
No, and I agree. But I think that's where the positives are in this movie. And you almost, by calling it a movie or, you know, calling it a narrative or talking about how, you know, Chapin using the idea that he uses all these filmmaking techniques to aid his story is sort of a futile argument, because I don't think that was the intention. I don't think that's what this is. So in that sense, maybe, Chapin, I side with you a little bit more, because my idea of this is that it didn't really work in the idea that he was doing it to aid his story the way he's done in Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz or some of the other movies we're going to talk about later. But I mean, I enjoyed it because perhaps that's because the way I was, you know, taking it in.
Okay. Maybe I'm not articulating myself clearly or whatever, but Jeremy, when I hear you say that statement, when every time I think about you saying that idea of fusing music and film together, mm-hmm. the scene I always think about is the Layla scene in Goodfellas.
You know,
it's such a great song. It's a classic song in this classic movie, and in it'd be so easy for that to sort of stand out in a negative way, right? Like Scorsese kind of ham-fisting in this awesome song, and a lot of ways I feel like it's almost. In some ways,
what's interesting about that scene in particular is, like, if you go back and watch it, and I could be wrong, but, like, I think there's, like, a half beat of the camera start, like, the shot starting before the song does.
Hmm.
And it's like, here we go with the song. And it's still, and for some reason, it's so self-aware of it, and like you're saying, but it works. It's great.
Yeah, it's... But I think what's interesting about that particular scene is that it is this really beautiful love song, but it's played juxtaposed to this, you know, both that mm-hmm. both Ray Liotta's narration, but also this moment in the sort of the story where everybody is turning up dead. It's kind of this that and it's sort of almost played ironically, and it's sort of using those sort of two mediums, that sort of the tools that Scorsese has at his disposal for making that movie. He can invoke that ironic tone, or I mean, maybe ironic isn't the best word for it, but you know, that juxtaposition can really really plays well. Again, I did not see that done as deftly by Edgar Wright in Baby Driver, and I honestly it got on my nerves.
Okay, no, I mean, it's fair. Like, and I think we should go back to what I think Lee basically said about the story and you know, how the direction and the story didn't quite equal out. Like, the direction I think was way better than the story, and I think that's, and here I become sort of not the anti Edgar Wright, but just this is where I'm a little bit down on him, is I agree with that with all his films. Like every single one, including Shaun of the Dead, which I watched Friday night, I think the direction is better than the story and the writing. Like, for me, I think he almost would be a benefactor of taking somebody else's work. Like, I would love to see Edgar Wright direct a Martin McDonagh movie, because I think McDonagh's a great writer, but not necessarily has the filmmaking skills. I mean, it's fine. It's pretty, like, orderly as far as his filmmaking, but I think Edgar Wright's a great filmmaker, but the stories he chooses, they're not bad. I just feel like his direction outshines everything else.
That's interesting you say that. I was listening on the way in to record this podcast. I was listening to some of our old episodes, which, by the way, will be available on our iTunes account soon.
Yeah.
And I was listening to your guys, this you and Brantley doing the best of 2010, which I think is a really interesting year to look back on. It was 7 years ago now. What was really interesting is you guys were talking a lot, of course, about The Social Network, which reminded that that reminds me of that was such a great fusion of writer and director, right? You have this writer who I feel like can really has these sort of magical moments, dialogue, very sort of almost like Shakespearean in its sort of timbre and beat and rhythm. But he needs an editor in a way. He needs someone to sort of bring all that dialogue together and the story and fuse it. And he needed Fincher to be that piece. And when you sort of fuse those two things, you had such an excellent movie. And it's interesting that you're saying that now from the director's point of view. So a director needing to sort of divorce himself from his writing. That is interesting. I noticed there was a kind of a big gap in his filmography, and I remember that he worked for quite a long time on Ant-Man. He was going to direct Ant-Man, and he had a falling out with Marvel, but you can see his influence on that movie. I really actually love Ant-Man, and I think it would have been a great, even better movie had Edgar Wright directed it, but you can still feel his influence on that movie, the way the sort of the dialogue evolves and unfolds and the plot and the storytelling. But yeah, that's interesting.
Do you guys agree with me? I mean, like, I feel like it's almost sacrilege to say that Shaun of the Dead is a better, you know, that I didn't love Shaun of the Dead because I think that in a way the direction outshined the writing. I mean, like Lee was saying about this movie, it's a pretty simple story, and I feel like there could have been a bit of depth there that really would have worked with it. But you know, people love Shaun of the Dead, so I'm curious if you guys and I felt the same way about World's End. So I'm curious, what do you guys think about the rest of his work? Does this sort of theme that we're talking about of story versus direction go through all his work?
The interesting thing is that, like, I've seen Shaun of the Dead, I don't know how many times, enough times that I didn't need to revisit it, but it has been a while. And I watched Hot Fuzz over the weekend as well to kind of refresh my memory there.
Another perfect example for me.
And, well, what's interesting is that, like, I think those are, well, Shaun of the Dead, I think, is great. Hot Fuzz, I liked. World's End is one I definitely would need to revisit. I remember kind of being lukewarm on it. But, you know, those are parodies, obviously, lowest form of wit. But I think that's kind of what makes them original. And to see Edgar Wright's filmmaking style adds an additional original take to them. And I feel like that's what made those work. So I guess I disagree in the sense that they outshined the movies. I feel like in the hands of somebody else, they would have been kind of boring and pedestrian.
Of course. Well, we're arguing this two different sides of the same coin. I agree. That's why I'm saying I think his direction outshines the story itself.
I don't think it outshines it. I think it works perfectly within those movies. I think,
but you're basically saying if somebody else had directed it, it would have fallen flat on its face, which I agree. I agree. If almost anybody else directed those, that, you know, any sort of middle of the road director, all of those would have fallen flat on their face.
But at the same time, you think the flaw is his direction?
No, I don't. I think the direct. I think the writing. Only thing
the writing works, is the problem.
The direction. Right? I think the writing is.
But what I mean is essentially, the direction. I guess the writing is the flaw, but the direction basically brings that flaw out.
No, I don't think so. I think the direction saves it. I just want to see him work with, like, really good material, like basic material. I want to see him do would have loved to see him direct Seven Psychopaths or an In Bruges. Like, I think that would have been so cool. I think that would have been the perfect combination of both their skills.
Well, what's interesting is that I think, and Chapin, you brought up that I guess he was in the conversation to direct Ant-Man, is what the first thing I kind of thought about after we kind of agreed to discuss Edgar Wright was that I could see him very realistically being, you know, and take this maybe with a grain of salt, but being the next Christopher Nolan in a sense, where there are really big movies in his future. Ryan Johnson maybe kind of stole my thunder with him directing the Star Wars movies because he's followed a similar path. But with Baby Driver, I think he's kind of separated himself a little from what was he was kind of being pigeonholed in with these parodies in his his Three Flavors trilogy, as it's called. But I think because Baby Driver kind of just showcased his skills and didn't really do a whole lot else, I could really see him just blowing up at this point.
Well, I don't see him as a Christopher Nolan. I use him
as an example because he went from sort of these smaller movies that he sort of was doing on his own merits, and then he went and did Batman. You know what I mean? Right.
Yeah, so I get you.
See, I would say that Nolan analogy works if he actually would have directed Ant-Man, but he didn't. I think the juxtaposition between him, you know, leaving Ant-Man to make this movie is kind of interesting. He chose to be a tour,
not to do it,
which we're sort of criticizing him for. I mean, in a way, it seemed like that aspect of it didn't really work. That the writing part of it, at least. I wonder. This discussion kind of makes me want to ask you something, Lee. you have on this podcast been often critical of Wes Anderson, who I wonder if he suffers from sort of the same fate as Edgar Wright does here. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because, you know, you do get these directors that are so stylistically unique that they can't escape it. My issue with Wes Anderson, it's interesting you brought that up. I literally was listening to a podcast with you, me, and Tyson about Moonrise Kingdom today, and you asked Tyson why he likes Wes Anderson and asked me why I don't like Wes Anderson. And my answer was kind of just this like character that he creates that's sort of emotionless. And that never really worked for me. But, you know, thinking back a little bit more on Wes Anderson, for me, it is kind of just his whole style encapsulated. And maybe it even kind of equates to what Jeremy was saying about Edgar Wright, that it outshines his story and outshines his film. So I definitely see the comparison. I mean, maybe I like Edgar Wright's style more, so I like him better, but it's definitely an apt comparison.
I'm reminded that they both have this sort of, I think if we are going to put a name on it, this sort of strong sensibility, right? This style that typically marries nicely with the writing and the sort of the stories they want to tell. But in some cases, Moonrise Kingdom is, I think, a great example of that, where I did not find the story particularly interesting, but I do find him to be a fascinating director. Same with Edgar Wright. I don't know if you guys have seen trailers for that new animated movie that Wes Anderson is doing, that Dog Island. It looks amazing. It looks visually just stunning, but I'm not terribly interested in that storyline, and I do think it's an interesting like arena for these directors to play in, where they're still sort of creating their material. But like, as you said, Baby Driver is, I think, intended or supposed to be a departure for him, or maybe a step up, a growth, a way to distinguish himself or elevate himself away from that the Three Flavors trilogy, that kind of style that he's established, and into sort of, I would say, I don't know, more lofty kind of storytelling, a movie that isn't necessarily a comedy, that kind of stretches him a little bit more. And I think, you know, ultimately for me, I wasn't a fan, but it's worked for tons of people. I think, Jeremy, you seem to like most of it, and it got great reviews. So it looks like I'm the odd man out.
Well, I mean, going back to that sort of idea of like Lee getting a little bit, I don't know, not liking Wes Anderson, or like, for me, the older I've gotten, the more and more I've now appreciated these sort of auteurs, and whether or not like their movie ultimately works, I'd still rather, you know, 10 times out of 10 take a Wes Anderson than a middle of the road director. I don't know why, it's like Christopher Columbus or something that just is trying to, you know, give you just
film the screenplay.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, so I don't know. I've come to, even though there's little things about all of these directors we're talking about that annoy me, I still really, the older I get, really appreciate these auteur directors a lot more.
Yeah,
I feel like there's not around as much.
I hope he keeps it up. Yeah, I mean, and I think you can still be an auteur without writing the screenplay, or you could even
co-write
100%. A screenplay. You could co-write a screenplay with someone, and
or you don't need to write it at all. Yeah. I don't think it makes you not an auteur director.
I mean, Fincher is, I think, a you know, an auteur in some ways, and he doesn't write his own screenplays.
Oh, I agree. He is. Yeah, absolutely.
I have to be quick. Whatever you're doing right now, stop. Go to your children right now. Kiss them. Hold them for as long as you can. That's all there is. Right now.
You know, if anybody out there watched the Super Bowl, I know none of us did. There was a...
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, there was a trailer for the Cloverfield Paradox, which nobody had seen before, and I don't think anybody really even knew that this film was in production or really existed unless you were digging really deep. And then as soon as the Super Bowl ended, this movie was immediately available to watch on Netflix. And I honestly, I think it was a brilliant strategy because...
Yeah, definitely.
If I watched the trailer for Cloverfield Paradox and then kept seeing that trailer and had to wait 2 months for that movie to either be released on Netflix or in theaters, I never ever would have watched what was the shittiest movie.
Yeah, that's really was it bad?
It was really bad. I mean if you want I can review it a little bit, but it would be uninteresting.
Okay, but like here's the thing, like maybe you guys know more than I do because I have no idea, but like you watching the Cloverfield Paradox, how does that help Netflix? Like, you're paying your $8.99 or $9.99, whatever it is, a month, no matter what.
So I think it more has to do with the subscribers that they got as a result.
At what point are they going to run out of people to subscribe? Because
they'll be the largest company in the world.
Well, that's sort of a separate discussion. Like, obviously Netflix is making a ton of money just pretty much through like subscribers paying $10 a month. So essentially $120 a year. Super Bowl ad alone probably cost them what? I mean, I don't even know how much those ads were going for.
Probably so, small two and a half to three, 4 or 5 million.
Right. But that alone, you know, and then the production of the movies and all the original content that they're making.
But yeah, they're investing billions in production. Billions. I mean,
it's insane. Like, as a person who works in production, like, I've worked for Netflix once, and it's amazing. Like, it's not that they're just, they give you a budget and it's like, that's the budget. But at the same time, like, yeah, that's not just the budget. Like, there's just so much money pouring in. And then you talk about like movies like The Irishman. Have you guys heard about that?
Yeah, right. It's the Scorsese's new movie.
New Scorsese movie that's like gave Scorsese another like $80 to $100 million to make a movie.
Right, and that's how much Bright was kind of the first one of the. I don't think it was the first original movie, but Bright cost something like $90 million, and they had advertising on TV. Not as much as like a movie that was released in theaters. But I do think that's a really interesting thing to discuss because I think the first point I want to make is. There's always been this talk about closing the gap between theatrical release and video release. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, let's just go back to Jurassic Park, for example. You know, you had to wait almost a year after a movie came out in theaters to get it on video, right? And if you think about it, if you invest, you know, nowadays people are investing, you know, $100-$150 million to market a movie, and you're doing that when the movie comes out in theaters, and then you're waiting 4 or 5 months to sort of have it come back out on video and remarket it. And invest that, you know, and so basically the buzz you've created has dissipated because the movie, you're not spending, you know, millions of dollars a day on TV spots. And so closing that gap between those two things where, you know, the excitement of the theatrical release kind of coincides with the video release, it has been something people have been talking about for years. And now we've got these formats where you don't even have to open a movie in theaters anymore for it to be seen and become almost a cultural event. Bright was that in a way. I mean, I assume it was a terrible movie, but
yeah, Bright was worse than the Cloverfield Paradox.
But people were talking about it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're right, but I didn't know if any of us saw it.
I couldn't get through it. But I guess my point is that I think it's an interesting way to release it. Like, excuse me, for us, you know, we've been discussing this week a way to find a movie that we can all watch and review. And Lee, I think it's been very hard for you. You've got a kid at home. There's millions of Americans are in your same situation. I mean, how do we feel about, like, if this shift happened where people start watching more movies at home? It's been talked about for years, this idea that people aren't going to the movies. I think it's bullshit. I think people will always go to the movies in theaters. But how do you guys feel as, you know, more than the average movie fan, people who are, you know, scholars, if I may say so? How do you guys feel about watching movies in your home?
I guess I should say
in lieu of the theatrical experience.
I would rather go to the theater. Because on the simplest level, the theater doesn't have a pause button and you're watching that movie. You know what I mean? Like, there's no getting up to get some food or whatever. Like, the theater is isolated in a dark room and you're gonna watch the movie from start to finish, and it's gonna be a different experience than sitting on your couch and watching it on your TV.
Right. And I mean, well, what's interesting is that, you know, we had this discussion, the theater going versus the instant availability, and, you know, if Brantley were still here, the downfall of the brick and mortar video store discussion so many times on podcast 1.0. But in the thing, you know, that we kind of always preached was that the theater is where the film was intended to be seen. That's where the medium is supposed to be shown. But now that you have things like Bright and the Cloverfield Paradox, clearly that isn't necessarily the case, right?
Well, also,
sort of made the same way.
I also might add to that that movies are so, like, you can experience movies in such a, like, in such a great way now at home. I mean, with 4K and HD,
right,
you know, it's not like, it's not like watching movies on video. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Lee.
Well, no, that was my next point, is that, you know, people are building literally what they call home theater systems. And it's, you know, and not even just like the theater room you have in your man cave, just the TV that you buy can basically show you a movie in perfect picture. Right. So, more and more, like, it's becoming unnecessary, and there is something, you know, immersive and kind of unique about the theater going experience. And I think, you know, like what you said, Jeremy, you can't pause it, right? That's what you're doing.
That's for you're those 2 hours, you know. That's what you're doing, and
it has your full attention. Like last night, you know, I was watching Baby Driver and had to pause it a few times because the baby woke up, or I had to get a drink, or I had to go to the bathroom. And not that it necessarily takes you out of the movie, but you're certainly not as engrossed in it as you would be.
I think it does a little bit. I think like more than you realize at the time, because when you're stuck in a theater and you're watching it there on that giant screen, it's a different experience.
That's true. But you know what? I honestly love going to the movies too, but I cannot stand to go to the movies anymore. People just talk all the time. They have their cell phones out, they're crinkling things. Lee, I miss the ArcLight so much, where, you know, we had to pay whatever it was at $14. I mean, that was 10 years ago too, so God knows what it costs now. But
let's just start saying, like, we should just, like, kind of shrink time.
Yeah.
We should just say like that was like a year and a half ago. So like 10 years is like 2 years.
Okay.
Why are we doing that?
I don't know.
Just to make ourselves feel better.
But I mean, there's a couple theaters in Portland where you can reserve seats, but they're few and far between. It just drives me crazy. I can't do it. I have these memories where I'm remembering what was bothering me in the movie theater more than I remember the actual movie. I remember that in when I went to go see Logan earlier in 2017, there was somebody talking throughout the whole movie, and both Katie and I yelled at that person in the theater. That's what I remembered. I don't remember that it was a great movie. I don't remember anything. I remember the people that are talking all around me and on their phones and crinkling things.
It's- I agree, Javen. I agree completely. It is so distracting, and the people... For some reason, it seems to be worse and worse than it used to be. Like, right? Like, people are, like, when you're in that theater and they're making comments and they're talking, it's like, we went to go see Three Billboards, and there's a lady sitting next to Sarah, and she was just disgusted with the movie, and she kept turning to Sarah to be like, this is unbelievable, this is good. And Sarah's just like, what do you want me to do? Like, go leave.
Why was she talking like to her?
I don't know.
You know, I think it just a lot is that the theater is not new anymore, right? So it doesn't create this kind of sense of awe for people. So when they get there, you know, they settle in, they're comfortable, and they just kind of go on with their lives, you know. And unfortunately, it continues even once the movie has started. Like even within like these last 10 years, I remember, you know, just being so annoyed when people would be talking during the trailers, but I could take solace in the fact that they would shut the fuck up once the movie started. But now it doesn't happen anymore.
No, it's interesting. But there's actually one point I do want to bring up when it comes to all this distribution and all these different like venues and places you can see stuff is what's interesting to me and what I have a hard time figuring out and what I think about a lot as somebody who works in the industry is, so the pie is the same, but the pieces have gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, because now you're competing with Hulu, you're competing with Netflix, you're competing with HBO, you're competing with the theaters,
Amazon.
You're competing basic, yeah, Amazon, basic cable, like there's so many pieces. And it doesn't seem like each one of these pieces then is spending less money to make their piece. It feels like each of these pieces is spending more money. You look at like all these, like Game of Thrones or, you know, any of these Netflix shows, they're all spending a ton of money, like all of it. And I'm just wondering, like, how are they all able to function? And is there going to be a breaking point at some point?
I think that's
wonder if there's going to be a monopoly to a certain extent. Like, is Amazon or Netflix going to, you know, buy Universal? You know what I mean?
Before we get into that, like, how are all of these different pieces functioning? And like, we're living in a world where everybody's like, have you seen this? Oh, have you seen that?
Right.
Oh,
I got so much content.
Like, I'm like, first I get overwhelmed and I end up watching, you know, Parks and Rec for the 18th time.
Right.
You know?
I'm the same way. Because I can't decide what to start.
Right.
It's such a production to like an undertaking to take on some of these shows. So you just try.
And these shows they're fucking expensive to make.
They are
cheap. Like all of them. Like
I think it's an interesting point.
AMC or HBO. They're spending so much money.
Well, but here's the thing. I think there is a. You know, if you go back, what all these resources or sources for entertainment have, I think the positive thing they've brought to the arena is that now all these great shows are coming out that we probably would not have seen 10 years ago, right? In a world where you just had cable,
for sure.
Or premium cable.
100%.
Excuse me. All this great content is coming out. And I don't know. I mean, I hate to be the person that says if it's viable and if it exists, it's making money, because I don't think that's always the case. But
it has to be. They all have to be making money somehow, right?
They do. I would assume so. But I am fascinated by the different business models and the way they make it work, right? Like, if you think about, I think, you know, HBO was so smart in how they did things. They I think were sort of the precursor to these digital venues where, you know, like Netflix and Amazon, because they are a subscription service, right? So, you know, people basically, I think they probably get a lot of subscribers from shows like, you know, The Sopranos to begin with, and then Game of Thrones. But then they can also support these smaller shows like, you know, know, Curb Your Enthusiasm and Looking and some of those other smaller shows that don't have as big of audiences, but that can still exist. They have a sort of a niche and they can support those. Whereas, you know, if those type of shows were on a network station, they would be judged on their ratings and they would be compared to shows like Game of Thrones, and because of that would be canceled.
It wouldn't survive. Yeah.
Right. And so I think the subscription model works very nicely in that sense. It's able to sort of, keep those smaller shows on the air because, you know, when you pay your $10 a month or whatever it is for HBO or Netflix, you aren't just doing that. You aren't just paying for Game of Thrones. You're able to access everything. And so it's a nice way to keep those smaller shows on the air. I think there's going to be a point where, I hope that all these services are able to maintain, but this, inevitably things are, you know, companies are going to absorb others. There is a rumor that with the new tax law that passed, that when Apple repatriates all their money from overseas, they might buy Netflix. So there's, I think, inevitably there's going to, and they could sneeze and buy Netflix and not even think about it. I would hope that didn't happen. I think Netflix has been a pioneer as a company, and I think Apple should pursue its own content. And then, I mean, it's really us, the consumers, that I think benefit from this, because things have gotten a lot cheaper for us to experience all these things. I mean, we have to sort of buy into all this stuff at once. Like you have to have Hulu and Netflix, and you have to have all this stuff. But I think on a show by show basis, I would guess that stuff has become a lot cheaper for us to consume. And I appreciate that all these little shows keep surviving with it.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I take away from everything that makes me feel better, especially as somebody who works in the industry, is that people are not getting sick of wanting content. Like, it has gotten, like, people want more and more, and I don't think there's ever going to be a point where people have moved on from wanting to see movies or TV shows or anything like that. So that's good.
Well, and if, you know, Cloverfield Paradox and Bright are any indication, it doesn't even have to be good.
No. Yeah, most of it doesn't.
They already announced a Bright sequel.
I mean, that one is almost Bright more of a anomaly than the Cloverfield Paradox, because people watched that because of the way it was released. But Bright showed up just like all its other, you know, original content, and it did, it, like, so many people watched it, and it was so bad, it was terrible.
Right. I mean, I think they definitely have some room for growth, right? And I'd like to see what we've just discussed. I think more applies to TV shows. You've got this wealth of content when it comes to TV shows, but that could also apply to original movies. You know, hopefully that happens, where people want to start watching movies in these places where they've gotten TV shows for the last 4 or 5 years, and the same thing happens. They start investing more. We've already seen that they, as you mentioned, Jeremy, they're going to invest in this $100 million Scorsese movie. That and so I think, I'm hoping it goes that same way, but they've got work to do, right? I don't think they've nailed. No one has released a movie that's been Academy Award deserving yet on a streaming service. But I think
Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah, but that came out in theaters too. Like, you know,
right? And that's a good question. Does it have to come out in theaters, like some theater, for it to be eligible?
Yes, for an Oscar. Yes, it does. For, okay, like, yeah.
For the awards season,
which is antiquated in itself. I mean, hopefully they adjust those roles, that rule.
Newton Haven was our hometown, our playground, our universe, and that night it was the site of a heroic quest. The aim: to conquer the Golden Mile. 12 pubs along a legendary path of alcoholic indulgence. There was the First Post, the Old Familiar, the Famous Cock, the Cross Hands, the Good Companions, the Trusty Servant, the Two-Headed Dog, the Mermaid, the Beehive, the King's Head, the Hole in the Wall, all before reaching our destiny, the World's End.
All right, let's get into our top five bar scenes. I guess so the top five is bar scenes, but we're going to give ourselves criteria. Everybody's different. So, Lee, I know you had some specific criteria. What were yours?
Yeah, so I knew there were plenty of scenes that took place in a bar or in a pub that were either iconic or definitely favorites among us. So to narrow it down, I actually said that the scene itself had to take place at the actual bar, if that makes sense. So at the bar top.
Yeah, there has to be a bar top. I had that too. There has to be an actual bar top.
So that couldn't just be in a bar at a table or something like that. So I'll kick it off then with my number five, which I settled on the scene in The Shining where Jack Nicholson is talking to the phantom bartender Lloyd. And you definitely kind of start to see the unraveling of Jack Torrance.
That's great. That one of the few, like, for me, like I said, they have to be, there has to be a bar scene. They have to be drinking or about to drink or making the drinks or something like that. And that scene right there, that scene, every time I watch it, I really do want a whiskey after.
Yeah. Something to be said about just sitting at the bar by yourself. Just, you know,
there's something
with the bartender.
About the longing in his eyes for that whiskey that really, really works.
That was just so relatable.
It's so relatable. All right, so I will go for my number five. So I tried to keep off some of the more obvious. Some of them aren't, but some of the more obvious. Like, I didn't put on the Inglourious Basterds bar scene because it's a great scene, but there's two scenes in there in that movie that I think are amazing, and I think it's probably number two to the opening scene. So I figured you guys might have it, so I didn't put that one on. And I said it has to be a bar that I'd want to go into, like a bar I'd want to visit and drink at. So that being said, my number five, a little bit outside the box, but it's when Mark Wahlberg and John C. Reilly are making, I think they're either margaritas or something, in Boogie Nights.
Oh, talking a good
about
pick.
Weightlifting. John C. Reilly is behind a bar in the backyard at the pool. Yeah.
And he's drinking out of the bottle as he's pouring it into the cocktail.
Classic. How much each other lift.
What a great pick.
Great scene.
And he says, you don't ever go to that gym. I would have seen you there. I'm there every day.
All right, Chapin here.
I had a sort of a similar criteria as you. It was a place that I wanted to think of as a place I'd like to go to. And I don't remember the name of this place. Maybe you guys can help me out, but it's the, it's a little bit of a cheat because I think it's a bar, but it's also a restaurant. And it's the bar that Jimmy Stewart works at in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Not gonna be able to.
I was trying to pull. I was looking up like John Ford and that movie to see that exact thing. I don't remember. But I do know what you're talking about.
They make like chicken fried steak all the time, and I just remember that being a place that I wanted to hang out in. I wanted to have. A bar from the Old West, and that one always comes to mind. I can't tell you. I don't remember the name of it. I haven't seen that movie in, you know, as Lee says, 1 to 2 years. But I remember it very, very distinctly.
No, it's a good pick. A Western bar was something I tried to get on my list, but I just couldn't figure out, or it's been too long since I watched the movies.
All right, my number four is a scene that actually comes right before a much more famous part of that scene, in a scene in which we actually play a clip from at the beginning of these podcasts, but it is the scene in Swingers at the Dresden.
Oh, my God.
Mike is making a fool out of himself with Nikki.
How did I forget Swingers? I totally forgot Swingers.
Hi, I'll have a Doers on the Rocks, please. Thank you, and some more olives for our little friend here.
Do I know you? I mean, where do I know you from?
You ever been to the Ha Ha Hole on Pico?
Nope.
No, you sure? Monday nights, open mic. I host an open mic there.
No. Oh, you're a comedian.
Yeah. Yeah, it's it's a dream. You know, it's a lot of hard work and travel, and you got hotels. I have a new booking agent though, so I'm part of the whole Vegas circuit.
money's pretty good. Now I might buy a car, I think, you know, a foreign car. Treat myself. I'm, you know, I figure I work for it. Why not?
I know where it is. Starbucks. I served you an espresso at Starbucks.
An espresso. Yes, that's my drink. That's probably it. That's great. Isn't that funny?
You came in and asked me for an application, and then I took you and introduced you to my manager.
Must have been a while ago, because I'm, you know, right now I have a booking agent, because it's, I've been, you know, booking, I have a booking agent now that I got, he's part of,
No.
Yeah.
No, I think it was about 2 weeks ago.
It was probably more, probably longer, because it's, things have been going very well lately, so I haven't been looking for a job in a while. But it could have been somebody who looks like me, because there are a lot of people who look kind of similar, I have a face that's similar.
You better
pay to me. Just take this, because I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thank you.
Nikki.
Well, it was tough because there's actually not a ton of scenes where they're at the actual bar. You know, and obviously the scene that just follows, he says he made a fool out of himself. They got digits. Of course they did. And he's a big bear with his claws and he doesn't know how to kill the bunny. But right before that, tries to impress Nikki, fails. That's a great scene.
Man, that's a movie that I wonder if it would hold up, but it really meant a lot to us 1 or 2 years ago.
Yeah, see, you guys made fun of me, but yeah, it's catching on.
All right, who's up? Me. All
right.
So another semi criteria, it didn't work every time, but was that I wanted to have what they were having.
Oh, great. That's a great one.
So for me, it was my number four is in Bruges. They had just, well, this is not the part I wanted to have, but they had just taken a bunch of cocaine, or he had just taken a bunch of cocaine, and they went to the bar. He knew he had to kill Colin Farrell's character, and he just keeps drinking these awesome Belgian beers, like one right after the other, and then the midget shows up on horse tranquilizer.
Yeah, I definitely thought about that scene.
That's a great one. Okay, well, I'm going to do this one because I'm sure it's going to show up on one of your guys' lists, and I'm going to just want to cut you off at the pass. And it has to do with you guys. So another one is I always miss the Boston bars, even though it's hard to find a place to sit in a lot of those places. It's easier to get a spot in over here in the West Coast, but mine's a tie. It's going to be the scene in The Social Network and the scene in the How Do You Like Them app. Or no, I'm sorry.
In Goodwill Hunting, the
Harvard bar. And so they're both Harvard bars, and so they become a tie for me. I love those bars, right? Like they're kind of old. They got a lot of wood. stuff like that.
Boston never been described more accurately.
I know. You should write the tourist books.
Yeah.
Boston, come to our bars. I got a lot of wood.
He's leading a duck tour, and he's like, this bar over here.
Oh, the wood.
The great thing is like a lot of those bars are older than any building ever built in Portland. You know, it's there's a lot of history there. It's great. That's what I love about them.
Well, it's funny. I've actually, and I don't know if I can speak for you, Lee, but I feel like you've never actually. I've driven by it a bunch of times, but that Southie bar.
The Goodwill Hunting one I've never been to.
No, but we've been together to.
To a Thirsty Scholar, yeah.
Yeah, Social Network one. But yeah, one day I'll just go in. I've filmed a lot over in Southie right near that bar, and I've still never been in.
What's it called? It's like the L Street Bar or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, L Street Tavern.
All right, my turn,
Lee.
All right, my number three comes from Kill Bill Volume 1 when she goes to see Hattori Hanzo, and she sits down.
Oh man,
at the
this
bar,
is gonna get racist real fast, isn't it?
Orders herself a sake, and it's so funny. It's so funny where Hattori Hanzo's yelling at his guy, throwing knives at him, and
isn't
that
then
he's just
a
talking
restaurant?
To her all nice. Well, she sits at the bar. She orders a sake. She orders a warm sake.
Yeah.
There you go. All right. We'll take it.
All right.
So that's my number three.
All right. My number three is I'm going to get this one done because I feel like it might be taken by you guys. But it is the drinking competition in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's a great one.
They're
really
not actually at a bar, but you can see the bar in the background. It's another one that I was like, well, you know, I wouldn't mind having one of them shots. And it's just a great scene.
It's such a
I'm just worried about you, Jeremy. Like, every one of your picks is just like,
no, that was
looks
my
good.
Criteria. That was part of my...
It's such a Spielberg moment when that guy takes the last shot and you think he's going to win, but just passes out, you know? It's such
Was that a woman?
It looks like a woman, but I don't think it was supposed to be.
Ooh, weird casting.
Okay, so I went number three?
Yep.
Number three is Rick's Cafe from Casablanca. I don't know. It's same thing from your criteria, Jeremy. It just looked like a great place to be.
Never been a place in film I've wanted to step into more than Rick's Cafe.
Yeah, I mean, like a little bit like a Disney version of it now. Like, I wouldn't want to be in the circumstances of being in Casablanca in 1941, but I would love to go there. The drinks are great. You can gamble. I don't remember anybody eating any food there, but everything looked so great. They are always drinking champagne cocktails, and just watching Humphrey Bogart makes you want to start smoking.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
I'm up with my number two. So this was originally down a little lower on my list, and then I watched the scene on YouTube and I was like, oh man, this scene is so good. And it really does kind of just play into the, you know, the mindset of these characters at this point in the movie. And it is a scene in The Deer Hunter at the beginning when they're at the wedding and they see the green beret.
It's a great one.
I actually forgot about The Deer Hunter.
They're just so excited to see the green beret, and they're talking to him about how they're shipping out. And Green Beret just says "fuck it," and De Niro's "fuck who."
That's a movie I need to revisit.
And it inspired us to drink Rolling Rock for 6 or 8 months, you know, 2 or 3 years ago.
All right. I'm gonna stick with you on my number two, and that'll be with the De Niro movie. It's Goodfellas. It's when he decides to kill Mort, and there's that like slow pan in with the Rolling Stone music. I know, crazy on the Scorsese movie, and he's at the bar and
the poster shot. Yeah,
yeah. It's. I mean, it's great. It's great.
Okay. My number two is the Korova Milk Bar from A Clockwork Orange.
That's interesting.
It looked like a cool place to hang out, I must admit.
You actually want to step foot in there?
I don't know. I mean, it was super weird, but that milk sure looked good. And I mean, I would assume you'd have to serve cookies with it as well, right?
Well, if that's the case.
Yeah, I thought about that, but I was like, there's no way I'd ever want to walk into that place. And then I'll serve booze.
Maybe they were like boozy milkshakes or something like that. Let's in our minds.
That'd be okay.
Yeah.
As long with the cookies.
Yeah.
All right. So my number one is a scene from Goodfellas. Not, however, the scene that Jeremy said. It's the scene where Tommy is told to go get his shine box.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That's very good.
One of many scenes.
Were they
in that
drinking
movie.
In that scene? I don't even remember.
Oh yeah, they were drinking. Let's have a drink. All right, everybody, let's just have a drink. Salud.
All right. Well, my number one. It's already been mentioned, but it has to be my number one. It is Rick drinking alone at his bar when it's, you know, obviously the famous line, "All the gin joints." Like I said, there's no place in cinema history I'd rather walk into, you know, barring the circumstances, than Rick's.
That's interesting. Now, why does he, that's such a famous line of all the gin joints in all the world. Why was it a gin joint? Was gin like a big thing back then?
Yeah, gin was like what they called it.
I don't know anybody who orders gin now. I mean, what, gin and tonics? Like, what else do you have gin in?
That's pretty much it. Nobody takes shots of gin or anything like that. That'd be
interesting, because gin is really kind of like one of the more experimental drinks as far as production. Like, you can make so many different types of gin. You think it would be more popular.
Okay, all right. Ray, it's your turn.
with my number zero.
It's already been said. It's nice when someone, it doesn't show up on someone's list, but they just ruin it for you anyways. Mine is the Basement Taverna from Inglourious Basterds. It's a great scene, and again, barring the circumstances that they find themselves in, I think that'd be a fun place to hang out.
Well, if this is it, old boy, I hope you don't mind if I go out speaking to kings.
By all means, Captain.
There's a special rung in hell reserved for people who waste good scotch. Seeing as I may be rapping on the door momentarily. I must say, damn good stuff, sir. Now, about this pickle we find ourselves in. It would appear there's only one thing left you to do.
And what would that be?
Stiglitz.
See how feeders into your Nazi boss.
It looks great. And I think the brilliant thing about that scene, obviously, it devolves into a violent massacre, but it looks like, you know, those Nazis were having a great time playing that, you know, racist card game they were playing.
It looked like a cool place to bars always look cool.
Yeah, no, it's a great pick. I thought one of you would have it. How about honorable mentions?
I had two. On mine.
One was when Leo orders cranberry juice in The Departed.
That's a great one. Yeah.
You know, I'm like, if I'm gonna pick a Scorsese scene, I'm gonna go with Goodfellas. The other one is kind of a small one, but I always laugh at it. It's a scene in Groundhog Day. It's the one when he knows what Andy McDowell orders, so he orders the same thing, and she's sort of impressed, and then she's like, let's have a toast, but he knows what she always toasts to, so he's like, right. I like to say a prayer and toast the world peace. And then this a minute goes by, and he just says, amen.
Yeah. A sweet vermouth with a twist, right? Isn't that a drink?
Yeah. 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 And I just love how he caps it off with the amen.
Lee, there's two that I thought you would pick, so I didn't put them on my list. One was the sideways tasting scene at the bar. I thought
so.
For sure,
full disclosure, like I actually somehow, some way, didn't even think of sideways for some reason. When I think of bars, I don't think of wine.
Right.
Really wondering if I'm in the wrong profession here. Also, now that I'm thinking about it, I don't know that any of the scenes at the bars, maybe the first one where he's kind of evaluating the wine would make my list, but I don't know that they'd fall ahead of any of the other ones I got.
Yeah. And they're only scene I can remember them actually at a bar is when they are at the, what's the restaurant called, Lee? The Hitching Post. They're at the
drinks the spit.
But that's not wine. That's not really a bar.
He pulls that off the bar.
But
I mean, it is.
It's a tasting room. It's not a bar.
Well, there's definitely plenty of bars. I mean, there's the one at Calaira with Sandra Oh. That obviously can't make the list because Sandra Oh is in it, unfortunately. The one where he drinks the spit. The one at the Hitching Post where they're talking to Maya. And then the one at the beginning where they first show like him evaluating the wine. There definitely are plenty, but. And I honestly really didn't even think of sideways, which is incredible. But I'm not sure any of them would have topped my top five.
There's a couple
other one.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, sorry.
Oh, I was gonna say the other one I thought Lee might have was from the apartment when Jack Lemmon gets hammered on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, and he's dancing with that lady. Yeah, I thought about that.
Those are my honorable.
There's the
Star Wars Cantina bar, which
Mos Eisley Cantina is on there. Another one I see on a list that I found on the internet, the House of Blue Leaves from Kill Bill, like that the place where they have the big battle with the crazy 88s.
I don't consider that really a bar scene, though.
No, it's more of a restaurant.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
When we were reviewing The Other Guys, and Jeremy was just like, I'm sick and tired of Michael Keaton being wasted. Like, let's get him in some good movies. And then he had Birdman and Spotlight.
That's pretty funny.
Sounds like it.